Joining me now is Everett Kelly, national president of the American Federation of Government Employees, which is the largest union representing federal and D.C. government employees. Thank you so much for being here, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you.
This is the order. I'm holding it in my hand. This memo, we can put it up on screen. And it went to all heads and acting heads of departments and agencies, shuttering DEI offices and other things. What is the union's response going to be?
Well, first of all, I think that we have an obligation to educate the public as to what DEI really is, because, number one, it's not affirmative action, as some might think. DEI is about making sure that, say, a veteran may have a handicap, an injury from the services, and come to work for the federal government. DEI would make sure that that veteran has the, I guess I would say, the opportunity to work in a job, and they would place them in a position where they could accommodate that veteran and so that they can do that job. So DEI is about that and about providing services for workers. It's not about the color of a person's skin.
And it's not a quota program.
It's
Let's just be clear. It
Absolutely.
Means that, you know, not, and it also, I think, for a lot of conservatives,
okay,
they believe DEI just means black people getting jobs. And so when they see a black person in any job, they say, oh, that person's a DEIer. They said it about the literal elected vice president of the United States.
Absolutely.
She wasn't hired. She was hired by the American people. 80 million Americans voted and voted for her, but they can't see through her race and gender. So it isn't just about hiring black people and women, right? It's about
That's right.
disabled veterans being accommodated. It's veterans returning from wars are also under DEI.
Absolutely. And I see that as a veteran myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
I see this initiative as a direct impact and attack on veterans. Of the 2.2 million federal workers, 642,000 of those are veterans. And so this is, in my way of viewing this, is a direct attack against veterans as well. You know, the misunderstanding of what DEI really is, you know, it's on us to really educate the public as to what it really is all about.
So taking down the websites is one thing to make sure it's gone. I mean, again, what is going to be the response? Because you said this is 2 million some odd employees. Donald Trump is trying to obviously purge people in the civil service in the federal government, not the political appointees, but the people who usually transition from, you know, administration to administration working in the civil service. He would like to purge them. The Project 2025 plan was to purge up to 50,000 career civil servants, replace those positions with Trump loyalists. Do you see this as sort of the first step in trying to do that, to purge civil servants and replace them with Trump fans?
You know, thank you, because so many people miss that. That's exactly what I see. Because, you know, this administration told us exactly what they was planning on doing, right? And they're doing it. This is an attempt to take apolitical civil servants and make them political appointees, make them, you know, loyal to the president of the United States and not necessarily the people of the United States nor the Constitution.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm going to play a clip from J.D. Vance, who's now the vice president of the United States. He was on a show called Jack Murphy Live in September of 2021. This was the advice he gave Donald Trump.
I think that what Trump should do, like if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people. And when the courts, because you will get taken to court, and then when the courts stop you, stand before the country like Andrew Jackson did and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it.
Andrew Jackson, who did the Trail of Tears, is interesting that he quoted him. One of the people who's now been subjected to what J.D. Vance wanted Donald Trump to do is a senior career official named George Toskis. He was a senior counterintelligence attorney who played a role in deciding to search Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence to retrieve the classified documents. He's seen everything in both counterterrorism and counterintelligence, said a former colleague in the National Security Division. There's no one in the department who knows as much about prosecuting and investigating terrorists and spies than George Toskis. His new job will be in the Office of Sanctuary Cities Enforcement in the Associate Attorney General's office. So moving him to a position in which he is not an expert to get him out of the position because Donald Trump is mad at him. What is the union going to do? What is your organization going to do about all this?
Well, you know, the thing about it, you know, we are expecting this administration to follow the law, to follow contracts, if this is a contract issue, you know, and if they don't, then we will litigate. You know, that's what we plan on doing. You know, this is about taking civil servants and make them political pawns. That's what this is all about. You know, and again, I said from beginning of this election, right, cycle, that this president that is now the president want to make sure that he have civil servants that's loyal only to him and not the Constitution, not the American people. That's what this is all about. And I hope that the American people will realize that, you know, it's not about nothing less than the loyalty to Donald Trump.
Yeah. I will note the National Treasury Employees Union said on Tuesday that it has already sued to block an executive order that would enable him to fire career federal workers across the government. So the lawsuits are already beginning. Everett Kelly, thank you.
Good afternoon, and you're listening to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Well, the election was yesterday. Have a lot of different perspectives from a lot of different folks, so thanks for listening.
Let's bring into the conversation the president of the National Action Network, the host of MSNBC's Politics Nation, the Reverend Al Sharpton. Rev, good morning. I know you were with the Harris campaign last night. Obviously, as the night went on, things became more and more grim for them, ending with shock probably this morning as this race was called for Donald Trump.
No, probably shock would be the word for many that were at the Howard University party, and then disbelief. I think also what we've got to deal with, you're correct when you say the economy was weighed on a lot of the voters around the country, and a distorted view of the economy. Let's remember, Donald Trump is a expert promoter, and he was able to get a lot of myths across the table that really were not true. But it was not well promoted on the other side. I think that we also have to deal with the issue of race and gender. There was a lot of gender bias in this. There was a lot of race bias in this. And I think that we thought a lot of voters were more progressive in those areas than they were. When you have the Dobbs decision, and you see this kind of vote anyway with the person that put the three justices on the Supreme Court, you have to ask yourself, are we fooling ourselves saying that Americans are further down the road toward dealing with gender bias and race bias than we thought? So I would say this, though. Donald Trump, I've known a long time, he will self-destruct. The problem that I see is not Trump. The problem is that those that can be appealed to in this way, and how we've got to bring this country together. And we cannot do it by being like January 6th ourselves. There would not be a January 6th on our side. We will deal with this in a dignified way and try to put the pieces together. So we've lost, but we lost a battle. The war is not over.
Well, Rev, let's talk about, you talk about gender and race. Let's talk about race. Donald Trump fared very well with Hispanic voters, especially Hispanic men. The numbers are coming in still a little early, but I think he did better with black men than was expected in the past. What do you think pushed that, especially with the Hispanic voters going for Donald Trump as much as they did? Because that made a big difference.
I think that a lot of it was he was able to sell a lot of Hispanic voters that immigration was a threat to them, that some of the people coming across the border was a threat to them. I think that we've got to be honest, among Hispanic men and black men, there's a lot of misogyny. And I think that we've got to deal with the reality that he appealed to this whole false macho thing that some black men and some Latino men went for. I think that we cannot sit around just bedwetting. We've got to deal with the reality, and we've got to deal with the situation as it is in our own communities.
Well, bedwetting gets you, political bedwetting gets you exactly this. You don't want to do that. At some point, Democrats are going to have to confront some realities that they haven't wanted to confront in the past. They didn't want to confront the past issues on the border. It took them too long to confront that. We talked about a transgender inmate ad that ran 30,000 times that the Democrats refused to respond to, despite the fact it was Donald Trump's own policy, because I guess some people in the campaign, we talked about this before, thought it might be, you know, maybe they were too woke to actually respond to a false ad and maybe they were afraid that they would be attacked by their own base. There are so many questions for the Democrats to answer, but one of them, the one that I just saw, that's going to be staring them in the face for some time if they don't do something about it, is that 45% of Hispanics voted for Donald Trump.
45.
That is George W. Bush. I remember when George W. Bush got 44% of the vote in 2004, it sent shockwaves. Yeah. This also, if you look at this, if you look at younger voters, you look at all these different, we've all been talking about a new Republican Party. There needs to be a new Republican Party. This morning, this is about as bleak as any time for Democrats since the so-called 1984 San Francisco Democrats. It's time for the Democrats to take a good, long, hard look at how this happened. And if they just say Trump bad, Democrats virtuous, they're going to keep losing. Because this, again, is so widespread. This is not about just Donald Trump. This is about the Democratic Party and being radically disconnected from the rest of the country. Look at the map.
Yeah, as we talk about how Donald Trump won, we had a number up there. It's important to point out Donald Trump did the same with black men as he did in 2020. Mm-hmm. So really look toward Latino men, where that number has gone way up for Donald in his favor. And we're just talking about New Jersey, a state that Kamala Harris won by only 5 points, and Steve Kornacki was just breaking down how exactly it was that close. You go inside places like Hudson County, these are cities, heavy Latino populations, right, and they went for Donald Trump. And that's something that this party, the Democratic Party, really needs to take a long look at.
That was from Morning Joe from this morning, Wednesday morning, on MSNBC. Now let's take a listen to Karen Hunter from The Karen Hunter Show.
I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Use abuse of that tools. I refuse to blow fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Back here when I was y'all. Yes.
I wanted to spend a little time as we were talking about folk messing with elections, because history is a great barometer. November 10th. 1898, yeah, I'm going all the way back because we don't do enough of that. On November 8th, let me go before the 10th. On November 8th, 1898, New Hanover County's Democrats used threats and intimidation to stop black people from voting. This is Wilmington, North Carolina. North Carolina is still pivotal to this day. Now, when I say Democratic Party, think today's Republicans. And this is, I think, we don't spend enough time talking about the Southern strategy, talking about that the Democratic Party was the party of enslavement. It was the party of the Confederacy. It was the party of, you know, racism, birth of a nation. That was the party. And then something happened when the Republicans realized that we are losing. We need those Southern whites. So they developed a strategy to bring those racist people into the fold. And that then shifted the party to the party of that, right? So the party of Lincoln turned into the old Southern Confederacy, which is why you have a Marjorie Taylor Greene and a Lauren Boebert and a Matt Gaetz and a DeSantis and all of these horrible-ass people in the Republican Party, because the party shifted. So when we talk about, you know, and you hear this a lot with folk who are ignorant beyond belief, Well, the Democrats enslaved black people, and why are y'all on the plantation and all this stuff? It's like, tell me you've never read or understood history or read for comprehension when you open your mouth and say stuff like that. It means you don't understand where we are, okay, and how we got there. Yes, Martin Luther King Jr.'s father was a registered Republican, because most black people out of enslavement were Republicans, because that was the party of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, etc. Actually, Clay Cain and the Grift breaks it down. You ain't got to listen to me. Go get the book. Best-selling author, Clay Cain. Ooh. And then we had, I think Kennedy was the first that kind of like broke the mold, and it was like the first Irish Catholic. Think about how wild that is, that an Irish Catholic ran for president and Joe Biden is only the second. that all you proud Irish people, you should be proud and Irish as Ireland's going through its crack epidemic. I feel like there is an alignment. It's always been about the Irish and the black. And then they just gave the Irish the badges to go police the black bodies to give them one up on the blacks, but we were in the same condition when we both got here. One was indentured, the other were enslaved, but they both had the same condition, and we were banding together. And the power structure said, oh, no, we need to create whiteness because they're going to outnumber us, and they know how to kick ass and river dance. Shoot, we got to, okay, let's bring the white people in and call them white and give them a badge and let them be the patty rollers and the overseers and make them better. They're better. Let them whip the, we don't even have to do anything. We just tell them they're better, and then they'll do all of the work. But it's still, you know, the Irish were dogs and all the things, right? Until they weren't. And then the Italians came in, they became the dogs, and, you know, this whiteness waxed and waned. But Kennedy was the first. It was like, oh, my God. And then Bobby, they'd kill him, kill the other Kennedy, kill, you know, and then it became a thing. And now we got Robert. I'm going to say less about that. But in 1898, in Wilmington, North Carolina, November 8th, the Democratic Party, think Republican, think MAGA Republican, because that's something different. MAGA Republican is not, you know, small government, Jack Kemp, Mitt Romney. It's not even Reagan, who was a horrible person. It's not even Nixon. This is Confederacy. This is the Northern aggression, war of North. This is flying Confederate flags, wearing a Nazi swastika. This is tiki torch carrying, the Jews will not replace. This is this Republican Party, right? So think Hanover County MAGA using threats and intimidation to stop black people from voting. In a very steamy election in North Carolina, 1898, right? And we just keep fighting because it takes forever. We were just talking yesterday. Women's suffrage took 70 years, 7-0. And it didn't include black women from the inception. We had to write ourselves into the future. We had to make sure that we were seen and heard. Didn't include us at all. Katie Stanton and them. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they didn't want black women to have rights? Hell. No, it was not about us. But it has to be about us. We have to make it about us. So for a year, so from 1897, this MAGA party decided in North Carolina to embark on a white supremacy. I'm going to call it white nationalism. I'm going to call it white terrorism campaign. We're going to have to change the language. I'm doing this in real time. I'm rewriting this to reflect what actually was happening. They decided to embark on a white terrorism campaign to try to drive populists and what we would know as Democrats today, politicians, out of office for the 1898 election. The campaign used speeches, think of Trump rallies, propaganda cartoons, think Twitter, and the threat of violence. Think January 6th, which wasn't just a threat, they executed to create support for this new white nationalism, this white terrorism, right? So they weren't recruiting. It culminated on the 8th, on Election Day. And by the 10th, here's what they did. One of the first acts. For 2 days, the election was contested. A mob of white men marched to the office of the Daily Record. So instead of the Capitol, they went to the Daily Record. What was the Daily Record? You in the back. Daily Record. Yes. It was the only black-owned newspaper. One of the most prominent black-owned newspapers in Wilmington, maybe in the entire country. And you know what they did to the Daily Record? They set it on fire. And there are pictures of them smiling, much the way they smile when they lynch people with their children. Hundreds of people standing there, burnt it to the ground. Standing among the ashes, smiling, taking pictures because they're proud. This is recruiting, right? Why would they burn the black newspaper? Why would they do that? I'm going to talk about this today because as I sit here, I have run away from journalism during the 10 years I've been on these airwaves. I cannot get it out of my spirit because truth is at the foundation of who I am as a person. But, you know, the need for somebody to hold people accountable for the things that come out of their mouths is important. And journalism was doing that. I wonder how powerful the Daily Record must have been. And we need probably a documentary on the Daily Record. I don't see too many stories. You probably have never heard of the Daily Record in Wilmington, North Carolina. If you're in North Carolina, if you're from North Carolina, have you ever heard of the Daily Record? And if you haven't, why haven't you? How powerful was this newspaper that the one of the first things these terrorists did was burn it down? Why would they burn it down? A black newspaper.
My days are cooler. Nights are warmer. And I put the blame on you.
In case some of you missed Democracy Now! This morning here on WRCT, let's go back and review. And this is what happened this morning on the program.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Donald Trump is headed back to the White House 4 years after attempting a coup to stay in power. In a resounding victory over Vice President Kamala Harris, Trump is projected to have secured at least 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the presidency. It appears he may also win the popular vote, which he lost twice before. Republicans have also regained control of the Senate, but the House is still up for grabs. The presidential race was called for Trump after he won the critical swing states of Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Trump's also in the lead in Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona as we broadcast. Trump's the first convicted felon and at 78, the oldest candidate ever elected president. He appears on pace to win the popular vote for the first time after receiving fewer votes than Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Joe Biden in 2020. We begin with two guests. Michelle Goodwin is professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University and founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. And in Atlanta, Georgia, we're joined by Carol Anderson, professor of African-American studies at Emory University, author of many books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Her other books include The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We welcome you back both to Democracy Now! After our four-hour special last night. Professor Anderson, let's begin with you. If you can respond to Trump's victory.
The Confederacy won. When you begin to really think about what he advocated, the kind of racism, the kind of xenophobia, the kind of hatred, all wrapped in a sense of honor and gallantry, and how that resonated with such a large, wide swath of the American public, that begins to tell you that you're seeing the backlash to what they call the great, you know, you're seeing the backlash to what they fear was the great replacement. And so this is feels like the kind of last stand of white supremacy, and it's going to put so many of us in jeopardy. And it's also part of the drug of American exceptionalism, where those who voted for him believe that they're going to be safe from the policies that he's going to rain down. And so that becomes part of the amnesia of not seeing how he handled COVID, not remembering how he handled COVID, of not remembering his tariff wars that basically almost bankrupted farmers in Iowa. And the kind of chaos that he brings, the kind of divisiveness that he brings. It's like living in a reality show and believing that it's not reality. This is a dark day for America. I think of Thomas Jefferson when he said, "I tremble for my country because God is just," because that's what we're looking at. I'm trembling for our country right now.
And Professor Anderson, the vote that Trump got, right now it's at 71 million, it'll probably go up 1 or 2 million more as other states are counted in and absentee ballots. But it's still roughly about the vote that he got certainly last time. But the big drop appears to be in the vote for For Kamala Harris. She's at the national vote is 66 million now, significantly below the 81 million that Joe Biden got. Why do you think there's been such a disparity in her vote totals this time around?
I think part of what we're looking at, because she was explicit about policies. And so the language that she just needs to explain her policies is hokum. It's that it is, we're looking at the misogyny and the racism and the fear of what it meant to have a Black Asian woman who's married to a Jewish man sitting in the White House, that this was not the kind of vision of America that that large swath that voted for Trump believe is America. It is the fear of what a multicultural, multiracial, multilingual, diverse America could mean. It means, and so you're seeing the backlash to her very being. It's a sad day for America. It's a sad day because there was a really explicit about the horrors of Project 2025 and what that meant for Social Security, what that meant for Medicare, what that meant for education, what that meant for equity. All of that could not override the depth of the misogyny, the depth of the racism that that fuels the MAGA movement, that fuels Trump.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Michelle Goodwin into the conversation from Georgetown University. Professor, your reaction to the results?
We have to understand this as a Project 2024. So the response, which I think was so eloquently put just now, is an amalgamation of a number of things. If we look at what the election results were based on race, it paints a picture in the United States. It paints a picture with regard to how people think about electing a woman, how people think about electing a woman who is Black and of Asian descent. It paints a picture policy-wide about what Americans are willing to embrace. And in that way, it's a Project 2024, it's a Project 1619. In terms of what Americans are willing to accept, to the extent that we know that Donald Trump is willing to fulfill on what it is that he says. He said that he wanted to criminally punish women. He said in 2016, 2015, he said that he wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. After that occurred, he took full credit for that. There were a number of things that he had hoped to dismantle. This was a president who, right after coming into office, had a Muslim ban, was responsible for kids at the border being placed in cages, being fed frozen burritos. This was an administration that had its lawyers fighting to deny those children soap and toothpaste, arguing before federal judges that those children who were locked in cages in federal custody did not deserve soap, did not deserve toothpaste. This was a president who failed on COVID, who made sure that he had medications for himself, vaccine, and then also sent to others, including what has been alleged to Russia and to Putin, so that there would be access to the best of what we had for COVID at that time. But for Americans, did not do a good job at all in terms of collaboration, cooperation, and leading with regard to COVID, and instead had suggested that perhaps injections of bleach and other things might be the way to respond to COVID. And one could really go down the list in terms of what that presidency represented, and Americans overwhelmingly voted for that. But is that something that is new? I think that one of our challenges in our country is to really understand the arc of who we've been and the arc of who we are. We tend to think that we actually had our own truth and reconciliation such that we have confronted what have been the thorny, horrific parts of our past. And we haven't. We've done the work of a South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Germany, right? We've not looked and said, how can we tolerate systems where women were denied citizenship? How could we tolerate women being denied the right to vote? How could we tolerate women being denied the opportunity to become lawyers? And I'm talking about Supreme Court cases. How could we tolerate women being denied from serving on juries How could we tolerate women being denied the opportunity to have bank accounts in their own names, have their own checking accounts in their own names? And that's a modern iteration. And then we could unpack what this means in terms of Jim Crow and slavery. How could we be a nation that tolerated children standing on auction blocks and being auctioned off? A bid upon, not for a horrific day where we wake up and say, my goodness, what was that all about? Bidding on children in shackles and chains. No, but not a practice that lasted a day, a week, a year. A year alone might have been waking up and saying, how in the world could we have tolerated that? But to see that flow into centuries and then to create patterns of justification and narratives for that, that then flowed into Jim Crow, a time in the United States that was marked very narrowly by what happened to Rosa Parks, but more fulsomely, the denial of people being able to walk into parks, swim in pools, go into motels, stay at hotels, live where they wanted to based on their race, and a practice that lasted for generations upon generations that then required federal intervention. So we have to ask ourselves, how could we have tolerated all of that? And in part, the answer is what we see in the election yesterday, is that we're willing to tolerate more of that. And then we have to ask ourselves, why? What is behind that?
Professor Goodwin, you're a professor of global health. You mentioned Trump's policies during COVID, and now he said he's talking about putting Robert Kennedy, the presidential candidate, in charge of women's health. But also Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said that he expected to be in charge of, what did he talk about? The CDC, the National Institutes of Health, a well-known vaccine denier. The significance of all of this, because it's beyond Trump. It's who will be in his government, from Elon Musk to RFK Jr.
That is a perfect question. And in 2015, 2016, I wrote an article about this, that while we could pay attention to, and it was right to, in terms of who would be elected president, what we needed to think about is who that individual would appoint to lead governmental agencies, because that's critically important. It relates to our clean air, the water that we drink, the education that children will be provided, and so much more. To place in context the Trump administration and COVID is to realize the following. There were more Americans that died in the first 3 months of COVID under his leadership than in 19 years of the Vietnam War, the Korean War, and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I know your listeners and viewers might be stunned by that and wonder, does Professor Goodwin have that right? Well, I have testified before Congress with regard to that. I have looked at the numbers. I have run the numbers. I've written about this. Yes, more Americans died in our first 3 months of COVID under Donald Trump's leadership than all of the Americans that died in the Vietnam War and these other wars that I mentioned. And so the risks with regard to Americans' health happens to be high. And again, it's a Project 2024 that we're looping out into a Project 2025. And I want to be clear about that, because it's not hyperbole. It is to really understand that there has been a struggle in our country towards recognizing that all Americans deserve to be healthy, deserve to be able to have access to healthcare. We are not like our peer nations, and ones that the former president would not call our peer nations, where there is universal healthcare, where there are doctors that even will come to your home, or where you can be treated easily. I know that they talk about in those other countries and you'll wait a long time, all of that. Americans have to pay a high price for their health care. And fortunately, there's the Affordable Care Act. But note that under his administration, and there were attempts to still do away with the Affordable Care Act. So what will all of this mean in terms of the people that he will appoint? I would say, let's not just look at what this means in terms of health. We have to look at this in terms of the EPA. We have to look at this in terms of other agencies that serve the American public. And I think that people should be quite concerned. And one other thing that I will add to that, Amy, is that it is very likely that there will continue to be global epidemics, pandemics. COVID was the first of its kind in 100 years, was the second. We, 100 years before, had experienced something like that. But these may happen with greater frequency. People move far more today. We have more planes that are taking people from one part of the world to the other part of the world. And so it actually is really important in terms of thinking about global public health that we pay attention to who is governing in these spaces in the United States and elsewhere.
And very quickly, Professor Goodwin, the historic ballot measures enshrining the right to an abortion passed in 7 of the 10 states that they were introduced, passed in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Montana, Maryland, New York, and Missouri, where voters backed a measure that'll overturn one of the strictest abortion bans in the nation that prohibits abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. The significance of that, and yet, at the same time, Kamala Harris loses.
Well, again, if we parse this out, what we can see is that white women overwhelmingly voted for the former president, but yet also voted for the constitutional protection or statewide protections of abortion rights in their state. So they were able to parse these issues out, even though Donald Trump is, you know, articulated wanting to criminally punish women and wanting to, and has appointed federal judges and justices on the lower courts as well as the Supreme Court in order to make it very difficult to access reproductive health care, yet they could parse their vote. And it's not just them, it's men too. And I want to make one clarification too. In Florida, it's being articulated that women in Florida rejected the ballot initiative there. No, overwhelmingly, the majority of people in that state voted for that initiative, except it was required that there be at least 60%. And what we know is that it's been over 57, 58% that voted for the initiative. So it failed by a small percentage, but it's worth noting that that was a requirement that meant more than a majority had to vote in support of that initiative.
I want to thank you both for being with us. There's so much more to talk about. And we've also extended this broadcast to 2 hours for those stations who are taking it. We have been speaking with Michelle Goodwin, who is a professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. And we want to thank Professor Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University, speaking to us from Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta, Georgia, that President Trump has won the state of Georgia.
And that was Amy Goodman from earlier on Wednesday morning. Next up, we have Roland Martin.
Do have to recognize that it is called America, and America history repeats itself. Hmm. But also, America can congratulate itself. America has decided to align with other nations in electing far-right, crazed, deranged leaders. And what you have to understand is that, and I'm going to keep saying, is that this is white fear. This is absolute fear of the future changing of this country. The Constitution, Declaration of Independence, that wasn't democracy. Black men couldn't vote. Men of means couldn't vote. Women couldn't vote. Black folks couldn't vote. I mean, if you were not a white man who owned land, you couldn't vote. So there's been a constant effort to change this country, to change its values. So what you've seen tonight is this country has decided that, you know what, Trump, those are our values. In fact, he's actually poised to win the popular vote.
Wow. Yep.
When you look at states like New York, New Jersey, Harris barely wins those states. Lower margins than when Biden did. When you look at the numbers, look at what the country decided. Country's decided, we don't mind if you lead an insurrection. We're good. We don't mind if you steal classified documents and lie about it and don't return them. We're good. We don't mind if you cheat with your company. We're good. Because you're going to bring back the good old days. It's going to be fabulous. The fact of the matter is, Trump inherits an economy fixed by Democrats. And he's going to immediately claim credit for all of it. He's going to say, oh, it came back all because I'm coming back. But do understand, you better pay attention when he lets Elon Musk run amok in the federal government. You better be scared to death when he literally lets Robert F. Kennedy be in control of science and health. Oh, you better bring back the mask and everything else, because it's about to be a lot more people who ain't vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And when polio comes back and some of these other diseases that we conquered a long time ago come back, because you've got a crazed, deranged, anti-vaccine person in charge. Well, there you go. Oh, please say hello to white nationalist Stephen Miller. My God. Oh, he's back. Steve Bannon, oh, he's back. And do understand, all of the same people you had before who served as guardrails, they won't be there. You truly are going to have a cabinet, an administration of zealots, of individuals who have no business holding on to power. And so America got what it wanted tonight. And America is going to get what it deserves. So let me say this right now to all of you white farmers in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Indiana, in Iowa, when he drops his tariffs and all of y'all asses go broke, I don't want to hear because hashtag we tried to tell you. And to all y'all people who blame the Biden-Harris administration for an awful economy, even though inflation today's at where it was in December 2019, where we had the longest period of unemployment at that low of a rate in 50 years, stock market, S&P, savings, all that stuff. Oh, by all means, when his tariffs plan shifts all of that debt to you, don't look at us who voted for Harris. Because hashtag, we tried to tell you. We told you by voting for that fool what was going to happen. So your health is going to be compromised. Your pocketbook is going to be compromised. Oh, by the way, when your ass start choking and your water tastes like crap, don't come holler at us. Because he is going to decimate the EPA. Oh, by the way, when your raggedy-ass state go acts a fool with the education, please don't come holler at us because of what he's about to do when it comes to the Department of Education. And again, all y'all white women who on birth control,
how about that?
Don't come holler at us when this Supreme Court targets that too. Clarence Thomas already told you they coming for that too. And so for all of y'all who said, oh my God, the nation is on the wrong track, by all means, enjoy his inauguration. Dance in the aisle, go dancing in the streets. But I'm gonna tell you right now, ain't no way in hell you think we're gonna be silent. There's no way in hell you think we going anywhere. You know, I interviewed Harry Belafonte, brother right there. I asked him about why is he still in America? He said, you know what? For all of my love of the French Riviera, he said, I stayed here to make it better. And see, I know y'all really think this is yours. I know y'all really, really think that we should go to where we came from. Well, I'm going to tell you where I came from. Riverside Hospital, Houston, Texas. 250 defend the street in Clinton Park. And then 222 Pennsylvania Street in Clinton Park. So we're here and we gonna swing. And I'm telling you right now, y'all act a fool. It's gonna be the Montgomery Brawl.
Yes, sir.
Cause see, we gonna throw the cat, we gonna throw the cap in the air.
That signal.
And when it's time to swing, it's time to swing.
Yes, sir.
And so y'all can play it cute. Oh, by the way, all of you working class people, oh, I can't wait till the corporations start laying your asses off. I can't wait, because Elon's already said that we need to destroy the economy.
That's right.
To reconstruct it.
That's right.
And see, all y'all who supports this, I'm sure Dana White is going to slap his wife around some more.
How about that?
And Trump is going to elevate him. And I know Jenny Thomas is just pleased tonight.
Yes, indeed.
And I know Clarence is saying, oh, Miss Jenny.
Ooh, God. Oh, I can't see.
We can now retire with millions because Trump is going to replace me with somebody hard right. Well, to the people out there who are frustrated and angry, and I've been seeing your text messages and your Twitter posts and all that, all I tell you to do is go pick up a history book.
Come on.
And do understand.
Come on.
That post-slavery, America allowed the slave owners to get their plantations back.
Yeah, they did.
As long as they pledged to abide by the Constitution. So the very folk we were fighting came back and got their riches. And the slaves didn't come back. But they did keep slavery in the Constitution and allowed the penal system to go forward. See, that's why the California deal is so important, because they don't mind that prison labor in California.
That's right.
So y'all can enjoy your win. But I'm telling you right now, a lot of you who voted for Trump and you're rejoicing right now, there will be tears. And when the tears come shedding, you can't cry on our shoulders. And you can't come to say, I don't know how this happened. And all we gonna say is, we tried to tell you.
Next up, we have some perspectives with Renee. One, she's talking with Stacey Abrams, and another one is a segment from her viewpoints.
Votes one by one thrown out. We successfully got that rule about hand counting votes one by one thrown out.
Yep.
Praise God. Are we in the clear, or should we expect any more funny business?
So we are done with the past bad action of the SEB, the State Election Board.
Okay.
But we still have a governor and a secretary of state who do not believe in free and fair elections.
Okay.
And we know that because the incredible turnout rate that we are seeing, the lines we are seeing, that's the direct result of Republicans making it harder to vote by mail.
Okay.
Because as Brian Kemp said, he didn't like it. He didn't like the result.
Mm.
So it's not that we have more people who have just suddenly decided, yay, I want to vote in person.
Mm.
They've been precluded from using another method. So they are changing lanes. Voter suppression doesn't have one example. They have multiple. Can you register and stay on the rolls? Can you cast a ballot? Can that ballot be counted?
I think because of how trivialized Donald Trump's sentiments have been, people, because of his personality, feel like they can relate with him and they see him as harmless. If anything, they can attest to Donald Trump maybe being a liar and maybe even a brat in some instances. But he's actually dangerous. Can you talk about some of the ways he's actually dangerous to American citizens?
When we think of authoritarian regimes, places that used to be democracies that are now dictatorships, the way they get started is that they seem harmless.
Mm-hmm.
They are brash. They sound different. They seem to be plain spoken. They tell it like it is. And that's how they get you. Because what happens next is that they convince you that people you disagree with are your enemies, that the press is lying to you, and that they know the only truth.
Mm.
The problem is we get so comfortable being in a democracy, we don't think anything else can happen. He may seem harmless, but that's part of the shtick. In fact, he has been the architect of stripping women of their rights, but we are the first generation to lose rights in our lifetime since Reconstruction.
That's big. That's crazy.
Because the last time they did it, we got Jim Crow. So let's remember what happens when you lose civil rights.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black.
But I'm going to keep it free!
Next up, we have Chris Matthews with his viewpoint from MSNBC.
Let's pick up on that. What are the changes that we see coming in foreign policy? I mean, we've always noted that in Donald Trump's first term, he was, you know, John is at the Lemire press conference in Helsinki, where he gets him to say that he trusts Putin more than his own intel people. There was what he said, but then there was a tough Republican Senate that would hit Russia with one sanction after another sanction after another sanction. So a lot of pro-Putin talk. But the actual legislation and the action toward Russia, tougher.
Yeah.
What do we expect this time?
I think Congress has changed since then, right? I think at that point, the Republicans in Congress, led by Mitch McConnell, felt that Trump was kind of a not particularly legitimate leader on foreign policy and was willing to defy him. Today, you've got a House Republican caucus that voted majority against the latest tranche of Ukraine aid. I think the other thing that's really important here on foreign policy, just right up front, is NATO. He doesn't have to withdraw from there. He tried, thought he wanted to do it several times during his first term, was talked out of it by more establishment Republicans around him. Doesn't matter anymore whether he actually pulls out, because what he has said about Article 5 means that NATO is, in effect, a dead letter. If you do not believe that the United States is going to come to the defense of allies, which he's made very clear is not a given, then it doesn't really mean all that much. And I think so you see all over the world today, people recalculating, recalibrating their expectations. Does China actually worry so much about the United States when it comes to things like Taiwan, when it comes to things like South China Sea? Probably not. Trump never expressed much of an interest in those issues. And so, yeah, I think, as Keir said, the world is waking up to a very different place.
And Jonathan, you look at China, and I mean, Donald Trump is, at least in the first term, he was focused on finance. He was focused on trade. He was focused on tariffs. He was not focused so much on Taiwan. And so now there really is a big question. Is the United States over the next 4 years going to abandon Ukraine and their fight for their life? And also the Taiwanese, because the Biden, this will get lost in history for quite some time. But the Biden administration was tough on China. You look at what they did from Australia all the way up to the Philippines, Guam. I mean, they really, really were hemming China in. I suspect he'll probably retreat from that one.
Yeah, Biden was tough on China and bolstered our Pacific partners, and he believed in transatlantic alliances. I mean, NATO not only was strengthened but expanded. The signature foreign policy achievement of the Biden administration is the way he rallied the world to help Kyiv, and all of that is now in danger. To Peter's point, Donald Trump never expressed much interest in Taiwan. He has made it clear that the aid to Ukraine will come to an end. His running mate, the vice president-elect J.D. Vance, has done the same. He also, Trump has made it clear to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, we should note, just yesterday, as Americans are going to the polls, dismissed the one member of his cabinet, Gallant, who was standing up to him, sort of solidifying his control there. And Trump has said to Netanyahu, do what you need to do in terms of the Middle East. So this is a reshaped world, and we are seeing these world leaders rush their congratulations to Trump. I mean, privately, most of them did not get along with him very well in his first term, but now realize that they have to deal with him again, and that includes Zelensky.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is an extremely nervous moment in Kyiv for President Zelensky, who now worries that his support for the United States could collapse. Chris Matthews, you were sitting in your home state of Pennsylvania this morning, a state won by Donald Trump, not as close as some predicted it would be. Kamala Harris didn't do what she needed to do, even in those suburbs of Philadelphia that are so decisive in these elections. What's your morning after assessment of what happened?
Well, several months ago, maybe a year ago, I began to study
the 50 counties in the middle, the ones that Carville, James Carville calls Alabama and Pennsylvania, between Pittsburgh and Philly. And in every one of those counties, it seems that the Trump vote between 16 and 20 had gone up into the 70s. And now it's, and I assumed it was going to continue in that progression. The red states, the red counties were going to get redder and redder. And therefore, he was going to do better in those areas and maybe enough to overcome the suburbs. And he did. He did. And I think that's it. And it's all about immigration and the economy. But immigration has been a terrible decision for Democrats. I don't know who they think they were playing to when they let millions of people come cruising through the border at their own will because of their own decisions. They came running through that border and they didn't do a thing about it. And a lot of people are very angry about that. Working people especially, they feel that they've been betrayed. They feel that their country has been given away and they don't like it. And I don't know who liked it. The Hispanics apparently didn't like it. They want the law enforced. And so I'm not sure they were playing to anything that was smart here in terms of an open border. And that's what it is, an open border. And I think it's a bad decision. I hope they learn from it. The economy, I think you can talk all you want about rates of inflation going down. What people do is they remember what the price of something was, whether it's gas or anything or cream cheese or anything else. And they'll say, I can remember when it was $2, now it's $7. And right. They remember in the last 5 years. That's how people think. Democrats don't know how people think anymore. They think about their country, and they think about the cost of things, and the working people figure, well, all these college kids, all the ones who went to elite universities, all looking down on us. Besides that, besides all this, we're getting condescension and deplorables and all that stuff. And they felt it. And they voted that way. It's for real.
I mean, and the thing is, you talk about the college kids that graduate and go out and try to buy a home. Good luck. I mean, even the young voters a couple of weeks ago, Democrats said, I don't know what this means for our future. We are not pulling in the young voters the way we used to pull in the young voters. So it seems to me, Chris, that and you're old enough like I am. You're old enough to remember this. This seems probably like the low point for the Democratic Party going all the way back to, let's say, 1984. You know, the San Francisco Democrats, Reagan wins 49 states. The party is just in complete chaos. But 2 years later, Jesse Jackson travels around the South. He registers a lot of voters. And Democrats, shock everybody, take back the Senate in 86. I don't know that it's going to be that clean and neat here, but man, there has to be a real re-examination for all the reasons we were talking about. A lot of it having to do with things that progressives don't like to talk about, and that is the political correctness. You know, we were talking about some issues here, and Willie showed me what he had written down on his piece of paper, where he's also talking about the sort of these things that upset working class Democrats that used to always vote Democratic and are now voting Republican.
You know, I think there's an issue here about gender, and I want to get into the issue. Bob Casey was a very popular governor here in Pennsylvania. He said that Pennsylvania is a John Wayne state. It's not a Jane Fonda state. Now, you can read a lot into that, but one of this is kind of the old values, yes, and all that about the male patriarchy, whatever you want to call it, all the negative things. But it's also a toughness. And I think if we're going to get a woman elected president, and we can do this in the generic terms now because it is going to be generic from now on, I think it might have to be a more conservative Democrat. A more conservative Republican. I think like Margaret Thatcher and Merkel and people like that, you want, and maybe Hillary was right. She had to be a little tougher on war issues because if you're going to run as a woman, you can't be, all three strikes can't be against you. Woman of color, that you're a woman and that you're weak on defense or weak on spending. You know, the Democrats have got to stop all this spending. I mean, I my wife loves to argue. She's a big Democrat. She says, you know, the economy's in great shape. I said, yeah, the more government spends money, the more it does, the more it jacks up prices. It just does. Yeah. That's what you do during a recession. You spend more money. If you spend more money, the prices of things go up. And that's a fact. And the Democrats never addressed that. They just went right past the graveyard and said, oh, no, we don't know how this inflation came to be. I don't understand that. Yeah. We don't understand the border price. Yes, we do understand the border problem. As a guy said to me, why does the little man love his country? Because it's all he's got. And if you're down in the dumps and you see your country being overrun from people from another country who just decide to come in for economic reasons, you're going to get mad about that. You say, wait a minute, the only thing I got is my country. Yeah. Well, that's all I got.
And you live in Philly or you live in Washington, D.C., and you've got police forces that can't keep cops on the force right now. And over the past three, four that's years, true. Crime has been everywhere in those cities. That also has an impact. You know, it's so interesting what he said about Bob Casey saying about your John Wayne. Mm-hmm. It's a John Wayne state. Mm-hmm. I know you've heard me tell this story before, but 30 years ago in 1994, my first day knocking on doors, I knocked on like, 50 doors. I came home. My parents said, how was it, Joey? I said, well, I learned that you're either on the side of John Wayne or you're on the side of Jane Fonda. I said that to him. I said, it is that split. And you see it the second you knock on the door. And I will tell you, that was 30 years ago. And that is still the cultural rift that pulls at Americans.
Understood. And you have to, within that, figure out how to win. And I think there's a lot of very legitimate discussion here about how Democrats lost this.
Yep.
But I just got a text from a member of Congress saying, you know, something else we need to look at is how people are turning to social media, podcasts, and other non-traditional sources for their news, and also news stations that aren't news. And I canvassed in all of the battlegrounds. I was shocked by the amount of misinformation voters were truly repeating back to me. Truly shocked. I do believe this is what caused the collapse of the Democrats nationwide. You cannot win when people believe lies.
But I mean,
I think that's fair too.
You know, and Willie, we talk about it all the time. We talk to our friends who are lawyers, who are money people on Wall Street. And they just give you misinformation. You're like, dude, where
smart.
Did you get that from?
Well, that's
educated.
And then you sit there and you talk them through it. And then they're like, are you sure? Did he really say that about Millie?
Yeah.
Oh, he didn't say that about Jane. You're making that up.
Yeah.
And then you sit there and you say, oh, here, chapter and verse. And then it's Willie didn't mean it.
That's where it always is. He's not going to put a 200% tariff. Come on, why are you guys biting on all the bait he throws out there? Well, we watched him as president for 4 years, and we take him at his word. Elise, we'll give you the final word here in this segment about lessons learned for Democrats and now what the next 4 years look like.
The progressive era should be over if they want to start winning again.
Wow. There's that.
Peter Baker.
Peter, final thoughts this morning.
Top well, that. I think what we've learned is that Trump is not the aberration anymore. In fact, this is Trump's America, right? I think for a long time, a lot of Americans, a lot of liberals and Republicans who didn't like Trump told themselves he was a historical anomaly, that he didn't win really in 2016. People weren't with him. He didn't win in 2020, no matter what he says, and that he will eventually be purged. Well, that's not the case. We're going to have a 12-year at least era of Trump, and that's a pretty significant era.
Finally, we find out that the Vice President Harris did concede the election to Donald Trump. This is from Face to the Nation. And thanks for listening today.
We are expecting Vice President Harris to speak at 4 p.m. this afternoon at Howard University, but we've recently learned that Harris has officially conceded this race to Trump. She did speak on the phone with him, called him to congratulate him for winning this general presidential election for 2024. And according to a senior Harris aide, Harris also discussed the peaceful transfer of power and the importance of being a president for all Americans. This is based off of what we're hearing from the campaign. And in terms of what we're expecting tonight or later this afternoon, Harris will be conceding this race and she will be addressing her supporters at her alma mater. This was a very important place for Harris. This symbolizes a place where she can officially come home. Of course, last night, this was the plan that Harris was initially scheduled to speak here. But of course, given the results, that no longer happened.
Nidia, obviously, the Harris campaign, the Democrats have a lot of soul searching right now about what didn't work for them during this election. We also heard that the vice president has reached out to Trump, congratulating him. Do we know anything more about any of the conversations that are taking place behind closed doors?
The campaign has been pretty quiet as of last night when there wasn't necessarily a positive outlook for them. But CBS News has obtained a letter from the campaign chair, Jen O'Malley Dillon, that she sent to her campaign staff. And in it, she addresses that the country moved to the right, but the least amount of movement to the right was seen in battleground states, and this was because of the work that the staff put in. She congratulates her staff for putting together what was a historical race in 90 days, mobilizing a lot of voters, and she says that the work here for them is only beginning to address the impacts of what a Trump presidency is going to bring to American voters. And this is the latest that we're hearing from the campaign. And of course, we expect as the days progress to learn more about what was going on behind the scenes, their take on the situation. But it's also important to recognize that the people working behind the scenes and with Harris's campaign, a lot of this is very, very personal to them. They've dedicated months, if not years, to building an infrastructure, to building a ground operation that was very extensive and large. We saw that many of, you know, staffers from the campaign side, official side on Vice President Harris, they were out knocking doors themselves, trying to mobilize every single vote because they were well aware that this was going to come down to the margin of errors. And though they were not necessarily oblivious to the fact that this was going to be a very difficult and tight race, this is still personal for a lot of the campaign staffers involved in this.
It always is. Nidia Cavazos.
This is the week after Massive Music Weekend. I did have a block on Saturday night at 4 a.m., you probably didn't hear it. It was the Effigies. I'm going to play a replay of that now and then get into...
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a hard look at the role that the U.S. Postal Service plays during national elections, especially under a controversial postmaster chosen during the Trump administration. Will there be delays in mail-in ballots, potentially affecting the vote count in this very close election? We welcome back Chuck Zlatkin, legislative director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union, to talk to us about these crucial issues.
We'll also speak with two of the three authors of the new book, Abolition Labor, The Fight to End Prison Slavery.
We speak with Professor Andrew Ross and also a former incarcerated person, Ayuba Thomas, on this terrific book, The 13th Amendment Abolished Slavery, but Not in Prison.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Free elections can too easily turn into hollow formalities when coercion, manipulation, or biased governance replace voter choice and participation. The United States Postal Service has historically been one of the most trusted government institutions in the United States, with a strong reputation for reliability and nonpartisanship until now. Louis DeJoy, a prominent Trump donor and former logistics executive, was appointed by the U.S. Postal Service Board of Governors as Postmaster General in May 2020. Just months before the 2020 presidential election. That board has the sole authority to hire and fire the Postmaster General. DeJoy's tenure has been marked by a series of controversial reforms, including slowing mail delivery, removing mail sorting machines, reducing post office operating hours, and limiting overtime for postal workers. These changes have triggered widespread alarm given the heightened dependence on mail-in voting during the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite public outcry and congressional investigations, DeJoy continues to oversee an agency crucial to the functioning of our democracy. With the 2024 election on the horizon and the ongoing reliance on mail-in ballots, particularly in swing states, the stakes are very high. Voters in rural areas, the elderly, and people with disabilities often rely on it to cast their ballots. Any disruptions could disproportionately impact these communities and undermine public confidence in the electoral process. Today, we'll examine the potential impacts of delayed ballots, changes in USPS service standards, and the wider implications for voter turnout and trust in the system. Joining us again today to discuss these issues is Chuck Zlatkin, Legislative Director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. Chuck, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's indeed a privilege to be here.
Well, it's a privilege for us to have you. As Election Day fast approaches, Chuck, please remind our listeners what operational changes Louis DeJoy has implemented